Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 19th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Garrison Keillor's Apprié. The presenter is Dave Crow, session number CRD 2006-1. Let's listen in.
Okay. Is it early? Is it time?
No, it's time.
Actually, it's probably over time. Well, for those of you who don't know me, and that's very few of you, I'm Dave Crow. I teach English at Augustana College, and I'm shamelessly starting this literature series with Garrison Keillor, trying to exploit the Scandinavian Lutheran connection. Paul was telling me that at Holden in general, people flit from class to class very casually. They choose one day, they choose another day. So it's hard to create a situation in which people can read for a session. And I find it very difficult to teach literature without actually having a text in front of us, without having something that we can read and talk about together. The only solution to that I could come up with was actually to read aloud to the group each day the stories that I find particularly interesting and compelling, and let that be the text for our discussion and see what we could do with that. However, I do have some copies today for those who'd like to follow along with the Keillor stories, and particularly if you're interested in coming back on Friday, there's another Keillor story that I was thinking of doing that's in this copy. So would anyone, I'll just start these over here, and anyone who would like can pick up a copy of that. Furthermore, I don't know if this is the time to talk about it. Well, by the end of the hour, I'll also be offering you a copy of Sherman Alexie's story, What You Pawn, I Will Redeem, which is tomorrow's story. You can read it overnight if you want. It's a terrific story, I think. It comes from a collection of Alexie's called Ten Little Indians, I think. Alexie is a Spokane Indian writer from the Northwest. This story is set on the streets of Seattle, where a homeless alcoholic makes a strange encounter with an artifact from his grandmother's past and then tries to redeem that past. I won't tell you anything more about that, but it's a great story, and so I'm trying to sell my class to you tomorrow. All right. So what I'll do is today is read the story, try to set some context and direction, and then listen to what you have to say about what you think is going on in these stories. I have to say that I think that Keillor is surprisingly complex and surprisingly literary. If you listen to Prairie Home Companion, you know that there are Lake Wobegon stories that have a kind of aimless quality to them that don't seem to go anywhere, and that maybe they're less engaging than some of the others. I do think that there are weeks where Garrison Keillor gets behind and finds it difficult to get the story written and kind of rambles, although maybe I just haven't given enough attention to those particular stories. Mm-hmm. But there are versions of the stories that are extremely well-crafted and well-knitted together, and elusive, and generating of questions. And I think that the two that I have to offer you this week are like that. They both were anthologized in one of the best collections of short stories for church reading groups that I know about. It's called Listening for God. It's now in, I think, 4 volumes. Do any of you know this the series, Listening for God? They're really, really fine series of stories with little video introductions accompanying them. This one, my church group at St. Paul Lutheran in Davenport, my wife and I guide a church reading group called Faithful Readers. We first used this volume 9 years ago and have moved through all 4 volumes plus a variety of others. So these are carefully chosen Lake Wobegon stories. And I hope you like this one. Any questions or comments before we get started with this one? Oh, you know what? I have to set some context before I read it, actually. I got ready for this. It is not, in fact, titled April, which is what I put on the board, because I didn't think anyone would understand the true title of the story. It's actually April, which is, believe it or not, in Middle English, because in about the second paragraph of this story, Keillor pretends that high school kids in Lake Wobegon are studying Chaucer's Canterbury Tales in Middle English, which was hard enough for me as a junior in college, and I doubt that they're doing it in high school and anywhere in Minnesota. But The Canterbury Tales are, of course, written in Middle English, which is a form of English that existed between about 1100 and 1485. It sounds like French or Scandinavian. Juan de Rapriu with his shura suta, the drut of marchat persa to the rota. You're going to hear that again because it's in the story and I have to read it. I'm going to give you a quick translation of the passage that he reads. It's from the general prologue to the Canterbury Tales. And then give you my sense of the reason why he does this, first of all. Roughly translated, the 10 lines that he gives us go like this. When in April, when his showers sweet, break the drought of March to the root, and bathe every vine in such liquor of which energy is engendered the flower, when Zephyrus, the west wind, with his sweet breath, inspires every hill and valley, and the tender crops and the young sun hath in the ram his health, his course half run. That is, in other words, in the zodiac, in the ram, the sun has come halfway through its course. And small fowls or birds make melody that sleep all the night with open eye. And even Professor Mary Moore, in my day at Luther, was willing to admit that when the birds sleep with open eye all night, they're not sleeping. It's one of those references, which I'm being careful about right now.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. So, April, in this sense, the title for the story probably refers to the stuff that interests Chaucer in Canterbury Tales. Renewal, rebirth, procreation, and gently, I suppose, even Easter time. But most importantly, the Canterbury Tales raise the issue for us of pilgrimage. So this is going to be a story about pilgrimages, about travel that has a specifically spiritual dimension to it. Travel toward renewal, strength, or change. Although really, it's a story about confirmation time in Lake Wobegon. Okay. Here we go. April. It has been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon. Spring has come, grass is green, the trees are leafing out, birds arriving every day by the busload, and now the Norwegian bachelor farmers are washing their sheets. In town, the windows are open, so as you pause in your walk to admire Mrs. Hoglund's rock garden, you can smell her floor wax and hear the piano lesson she's giving, the tune that goes da-da-da, da-da-da-da. And up by school, smell the macaroni cheese hot dish for lunch, and hear from upstairs the voices of Miss Melrose's class reciting Chaucer. Blonde Rapriu with his shura suta, the drut of March hath persa to the ruta, and bathed every vine in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendereth the fluor. While Zephyrus ate with his sweet breath, in spirit hath in every holt and heath, the tender croppers, and the younger son hath in the ram his half a coursey runner. And smaller fools mock in melodia that sleep in all the night with apnea. The words are 600 years old and describe spring in this little town quite well. The sweet breath of the wind, the youth of the sun, the sweet rain, the tender crops, the small fowls making melodies, we have them all. I made a pilgrimage up there last Sunday to visit my family, and my family wasn't there. I walked in, called, there was no answer. I drove over to Aunt Flo's to look for them and got caught in a Sunday morning rush hour. It was Confirmation Sunday at Lake Wobegon Lutheran Church. 13 young people had their faith confirmed and were admitted to the circle of believers. 13 dressed up boys and girls at the altar rail in front of a crowd of every available relative. Pastor Inquist asked them all the deepest questions about the faith, questions that have troubled theologians for years, which these young people answered readily from memory and then partook of their first communion. Later, they lounged around on the front steps and asked each other, were you scared? And said, no, I wasn't really, not as much as I thought I'd be. And went home to eat chuck roast, and some of them had their first real cup of coffee. They found it to be a bitter, oily drink that makes you dizzy and sick to your stomach. But they were Lutherans now, and that was what Lutherans drink. The Tollerudes, for example, drank gallons of coffee on Sunday. Church had been 2 hours long, the regular service plus confirmation, and Lutherans don't have the opportunities to stand up and kneel down and get exercise that you find elsewhere. So everyone was stiff and dopey, and the Tollerudes, when they sit around and visit, are all so quiet and agreeable they get drowsy. So they drink plenty of coffee. Years ago, when Uncle Gunnar was alive, they didn't need so much. He had wild white hair and eyebrows the size of mice. He spilled food down himself and didn't care. He had whiskey on his breath. And if anyone mentioned the Lutheran church, he said, Paw! He was an old bachelor who got rich from founding a chain of private clubs in the Dakotas and Iowa called the Quality Prestige Clubs. They were only empty rooms over a drugstore with some old leather couches and a set of Collier's Encyclopedia, and he gave away memberships to men who'd never been invited to a club before, tall, sad men with thin, dry hair, of whom there were a lot, and made his money selling them lots of shirts and ties and cufflinks with the QP insignia. Uncle Gunnar got rich and sold the clubs to an Iowa meat packer and went to Australia to get into some line of work down there that he didn't consider worth mentioning. And the last anyone saw of him was in 1962. Presumably he died, unless perhaps he just got tired of us knowing him. The Tollerudes gathered for pot roast because Daryl and Marilyn's daughter Lois was confirmed. She sat at the head of the table next to her dad, promoted from the children's table out in the kitchen. She is a tall, lanky girl who has grown 4 inches this year, and it has tired her out. She is quieter than she used to be. A tall, shy girl with long brown hair she has learned to tie into an elegant bun, and creamy skin that she keeps beautiful by frequent blushing, which is good for the circulation and makes her lovelier whenever she is admired. A boy who has sat silently across from her in geometry since September has written her a 27-page letter in small print, telling her how he feels about her. Since September, he's looked as if he was just about to talk, and now it all comes out at once. He thinks God has written their names together in the book of love. But she isn't thinking about him Sunday. She was blushing to see her confirmation cake with the scripture verse inscribed in blue frosting, "Be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." It was a large cake, and Marilyn used the extra fine nozzle on the frosting gun. There it sat, lit with birthday candles, and Lois didn't know how to tell them that she wasn't sure she believed in God. She was pretty sure she might have lost her faith. She thought she might have lost it on Friday night, or sometime Saturday morning, she wasn't sure. She didn't mention it at the time because she thought she might get it back. On Friday night, less than 48 hours before confirmation, she was sitting on the couch watching television with Dave, the boy who wrote the letter, while her mom and dad were going to have supper with her prayer parents. When you're confirmed, you're assigned prayer parents, a couple who promised to pray for you for 3 months prior, and Lois has turned out to be the Val Tollefsons, people she had never liked. To think that every night over supper, Val Tollefson had bowed his big, thick head and said, "And Lord, we ask thee to strengthen Lois in her faith," the same man who once said, "You won't amount to a hill of beans. You don't have the sense that God gave geese." She could feel her faith slip a little. She felt guilty because Dave wasn't supposed to be there, and she was supposed to be ironing her confirmation dress, but he had walked 2 miles from his house, so what could she do? She felt sorry for Dave. He always had a bad haircut and a swarm of pimples on his forehead. But she likes him. He's quiet and nice. They talked to each other at Luther League get-togethers about what it would be like to be someone else. Someone famous, for example, like Willie Nelson. You could use your fame to do good. And they went for one walk halfway around the lake holding hands. And then she got the long letter saying how much she meant to him. 27 pages, which was much more than she wanted to mean to him. It scared her. She didn't know that Dave was a born writer, that 27 pages is nothing to him. He did 31 on the death of his dog, Buff. She told him it would be better if they didn't see each other anymore. Friday night, he walked over, full of more to say. She had 4 little brothers and a sister to take care of, so he sat on the old red sofa with a bottle of orange pop and watched as she fed the baby, and she turned on the TV and lost her faith. Men in khaki suits were beating people senseless, shooting them with machine guns, throwing the bodies out of helicopters. Their reception was so poor, the picture so fuzzy, it was more like radio, which made the horrors worse, she thought. This could happen here. It gave her a cold chill to imagine violent, strange men bursting in, as they had done to Anne Frank. She held the baby Karen, imagining all of them were hiding from Nazis, and heard twigs crunch outside and knew this boy could not protect her. She prayed and heard something like an echo, as if the prayer was only in her head. The whole world in the control of dark powers, working senseless evil in our lives, and prayer went no place. Prayer just went up the chimney like smoke. When Marilyn cut the confirmation cake and served it with butter brickle ice cream, Lois thought, "I should say something," like, "I don't believe in God, I don't think." Nobody would need coffee then. After dinner, she put on her jeans and a white jacket and walked out across the cornfield toward the road and the ravine to think about her faith on this cloudy day. And walking west over a little rise, she saw, just beyond the ravine, a white car she'd never seen before, and a strange man in a trench coat standing beside it. She walked toward him, thinking of the parable of the Good Samaritan, thinking that perhaps God was calling her to go witness to him and thereby recover her faith. He stood and pitched stones up over the trees, and as she got closer, he turned and smiled, put out his hand, and came toward her. She saw her mistake. Something glittered in his mouth. She stopped. He was a killer come looking for someone. It didn't matter to him who it was. Anyone who came down the road would do. He walked toward her. She turned and fell down and said, "Oh, please, no. Please, God, no." I hadn't seen her for 5 years. I said, "Lois, Lois, it's me." I helped her up. "How are you? It's good to see you again." We shuffled along the rim of the ravine looking for the thin path down. And she told me about her confirmation, which I have an interest in because I am her godfather. I wasn't invited to church, I reckon, because 14 years ago, I wasn't anyone's first choice for godfather. I was nominated by Marilyn because Daryl suggested his brother Gunnar, and she thought that was ridiculous. And to show Daryl what a poor choice he would be, she suggested me. And Daryl said, "Sure, fine, if that's what you want," and they were stuck with me. The baby was named for her mother's Sunday school teacher, who was my Aunt Lois. My youngest aunt, so young, she was like an older sister. She was single when I was a boy, and so had plenty of time for her favorite nephew. She told me I was. She said, "Don't tell the others, but you are the one I love more than anyone else," or words to that effect. We were riding the bus to Minneapolis, she and I, to visit great Aunt Posey. Lois seemed young to me because she loved to pretend. We imagined the bus was our private bus, and we could go anywhere we wanted. We were somebody. My favorite game was strangers, pretending we didn't know each other. I'd get up and walk to the back of the bus and turn around and come back to the seat and say, "Do you mind if I sit here?" And she said, "No, I don't mind," and I'd sit. And she'd say, "A very pleasant day, isn't it?" We didn't speak it this way in our family, but she and I were strangers, and so we could talk as we pleased. "Are you going all the way to Minneapolis, then?" "As a matter of fact, ma'am, I'm going to New York City. I'm in a very successful hit play on Broadway, and I came back out here to Minnesota because my sweet old aunt died, and I'm going back to Broadway now on the evening plane. The next week I go to Paris, France, where I currently reside on the Champs-Élysées. My name is Tom Flambeau. Perhaps you've read about me." "No, I never heard of you in my life, but I'm very sorry to hear about your aunt. She must have been a wonderful person." "Oh, she was pretty old. She was all right, I guess." "Are you very close to your family, then?" "No, not really. I'm adopted, you see. My real parents were Broadway actors. They sent me out to the farm thinking I'd get more to eat. But I don't think the people out here understand people like me." She looked away from me. She looked out the window a long time. I'd hurt her feelings. Minutes passed, but I didn't know her. Then I said, "Talk to me, please." She said, "Sir, if you bother me anymore, I'll have the driver throw you off this bus. Say that you know me, please." And when I couldn't bear it one more second, she touched me, and I was myself again. And the next time we rode the bus, I said, "Let's pretend we don't know each other." She said, "No, you get too scared." "I won't this time." I got up and came back and said, "It's a very pleasant day, isn't it? Are you going to Minneapolis?" Eventually we do. We pretend to be someone else and need them to say they know us. But one day we become that person and they simply don't know us. From that, there is no bus back that I know of. Lois Tollerud asked me, "Why did you stop here?" I told her I had parked by the ravine looking for a spot where our Boy Scout troop used to camp and where Einar Tingbold, the scoutmaster, got so mad at us once, he threw 2 dozen eggs one by one into the woods. Each egg made him madder and he threw it farther. Then he ran out of eggs. When he ran out of eggs, he reached for something else. It was his binoculars. He didn't want to throw them away, but he was so furious he couldn't stop. He threw the binoculars and reached for them in the same motion, heaved them and tried to grab the strap as it went by. We scouts looked for it a whole afternoon 30 years ago. Whenever I go by the ravine, I look for a reflection of glass, thinking that if I found those binoculars by some wonderful luck and took them back to him, he might forgive me. "That's not true, is it?" She said, "No, it's not." I stopped there because, frankly, I'd had a lot of coffee, but I couldn't tell her that. We walked for almost a mile along that ravine to the lake and back, and then I felt like I'd like to visit her family after all. We walked in. I got a fairly warm hello and was offered coffee. "In a minute," I said. "Excuse me, I'll be right back." I had a cup and a slice of cake that said "con but for" a little triangle out of her verse. "Be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed. Our lovely world has the power to make us brave. A person wants to be someone else and gets scared and needs to be known, but we ride so far on that bus, we become the stranger. Nevertheless, these things stay the same, the sweet breath, the rain, the tender crops, and the small fowls making melodies. God watches each one and knows when it falls, and so much more does he watch us all." So there it is. So, any reactions to that story before we take the watch apart and see how it ticks? Some people find that pleasant, and other people really dislike it. I don't know if you want to admit to being one or the other. Literary analysis, in other words. I think the best way to do it is to take it apart piece by piece, show how it works, but then bring it back together and enjoy the ticking, if you can. Any questions or reactions to the story?
I just have to admit that I love being read to so much that I find myself just wandering into being read to and miss little bits and pieces along the way.
It's a powerful thing, isn't it?
It is very powerful.
Those of us who become English majors probably got read to sometime in our childhood and can't ever shake it.
Yeah,
for me it was my mom reading Heidi to me when I was in second grade waiting for the bus, I think. You know? I'm not sure. Well, if you had to point to the stuff in the story that's least well, you know, nailed down, the stuff that seems to spin out and to raise questions, what would you point to?
One part for me would be the relationship or semi-relationship with this young man who wrote her this 27-page letter
of the Dave story.
And it scared her, so she said goodbye.
Okay, I'm going to put that over here. What about that Dave story? What do you think Keeler gets out of that little narrative?
Awkwardness of first relationship.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm sure something like that.
Fear of intimacy.
Love, relationships. Intimacy. And as you said just now, fear. Fear of intimacy, but also larger fears you notice in that passage, right? She oddly watches this television show. We see them all the time, but she actually starts to feel afraid because of the violence she sees on the show. Mm-hmm. And she thinks, this kid can't protect me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to end up with a person who can protect me from this world. So there's also stuff about the world here, which is violent. And lest we think that that violence is just TV violence, what detail does Keeler give us? Anne Frank, who literally was killed by people in khaki suits. So we actually get a really brief reference to the Holocaust there, of all things, in a Lake Wobegon tale. Okay, so, yeah, he's got some work done there. Anything else that you'd like to point to in that passage?
Well, if this kid could write a 27-page letter explaining how much he cared about her, an even longer letter about his dog.
Right.
How much depth did he really have?
Yeah, there's satire there too, isn't there? The satire on writers. Keeler himself appears twice in the story, or in two characters, and Dave is one of them, I think, right? The tall, pimply writer who, exaggerates the violence of the world, exaggerates his own love for the girl, or something like that. Of course, the other person is the godfather, the storyteller who is found out by the ravine. Yeah. Okay. Point to other parts of the story that we can kind of trick out the same way. Stuff that seems to raise the most interesting questions for you.
That she was having to take care of four children.
Yeah. Yeah, all right. Maybe the issue of the babysitting? Well, she's babysitting her own brothers and sisters, right?
It made me wonder what the circumstances were.
Right. She's doing some co-parenting there, isn't she? Which, you know, under the circumstances, since we're talking about confirmation here, must raise the question of adulthood and what adulthood is about. What does it mean to become an adult, I suppose? And that's the first thing that occurs to me. You may want to take it somewhere else.
Well, I was, that and along with the losing of her faith, I'm not sure. I guess we all, adults and young people, lose our faith every once in a while, but she was entertaining herself maybe when she was babysitting or the TV on, and I was trying to figure it out there.
I'm not sure I have the threads figured out either in this story, but you're absolutely right that we know as adults that doubt in our faith lives is a pretty natural thing. It's something, I suppose, that we struggle with, that we live with our whole lives long. Lois doesn't seem to be aware of that yet. She's such a young girl. For her, every emotion and every spiritual longing is absolutely fresh and new for her. So that's one of the problems, I suppose. I want to come back to that. I think that's going to be really important in this story. Yeah.
I also, and this may be where I sort of just went into being read to, but the the real close to home scariness of the binoculars.
Yeah.
Throwing the eggs. I missed what made that anger brew so much that you'd throw two dozen eggs one at a time and then throw binoculars.
We have to speculate. Because the only other information we get is that the Keeler character, the storyteller, had made the scout leader so angry that he threw these. And in fact, he knows he was responsible because he wants to be forgiven.
Yeah, but doesn't say...
What
did he do to make him so...
Well, let's imagine any of the maddening things that children can do to send us over the edge, right? I think that's it.
Okay.
That's the strength. You don't need to explain it. You just realize there are those moments if you've ever been a scoutmaster.
Yeah, right, exactly. And Keeler is so dang good at that. You know, he taps into our knowledge of these things so well. Yeah. You know, I don't want to press imagery and symbolism too hard because I think that's annoying to people. And you wonder even yourself when you reach the point where you start to symbol hunt and take the story away from the sort of natural, straightforward meaning that it has. But it did occur to me as I was reading aloud, which is about the fourth time I've read this story in the last 2 days, that eggs and binoculars are really interesting objects to choose for that fit of anger. We might want to come back to that, actually, when we get ourselves a little further down the road with this. Is that what you wanted to talk about, too? Or?
No, it was just I was just curious about that. What made that? What made that guy so angry that he would choose that and choose the a food item? I don't know how far out they were, but
Well, remember too that it's a made up story. The truth is he's in the weeds because he needs to pee,
mm-hmm.
and he's told Lois to avoid telling her that. And apparently has a compulsive need to tell stories. I mean that's why I think it's Keeler again
mm-hmm.
that. He tells this crazy story about an angry scoutmaster for some reason, which is really interesting. The story is absolutely filled, in spite of the fact it's only, 6 pages long, absolutely filled with references to people who tell stories, lies, fibs, and fantasies. Did you notice that? on the bus. People tell fantasies about themselves. The kids fantasize about being Willie Nelson or about being famous. Over and over and over again, people have this impulse to be other than they are. Which I think, by the way, brings us back to something nobody else has mentioned so far. Fred, you needed to have done this. This is up your alley. Romans 12:2. He's the Bible study leader, that's why. Bible verse on the cake. Be ye not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed. Any comment on that one? Any wisdom on that verse?
Well, all I can think of is what comes after it, you know, the way you do that. But, I mean, obviously they're all transforming themselves.
Right, but
exactly. And maybe in some way I'm not noticing, they do it in service of each other, which is what the transformation...
Which is what St. Paul wants.
Yeah. You need to figure out a way to transform yourself so that you not only are different, but that you're good for something for somebody else.
Right. Yeah. You're transformed not just in any old way, right? But you're transformed actually into the mind of God somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? You're guided by the Spirit in some important way that you hadn't been before. I think that's a powerful, powerful thing, a powerful notion to put in at the center of a little story like this one. It makes us really sort of grapple with some important issues. And then all this business of transforming, becoming a different person, it gets an edge to it. Yeah, go ahead.
The line that jumped out at me in this whole thing was after he had the thing with the aunt and they were pretending to be somebody else, and they talks about how eventually we pretend to be someone else and need to say they know us, and then... The line from that, there is no bus back that I recall.
Exactly.
Like, whoa.
Yeah.
Because to me, that had an edge on it that some of the rest of it didn't.
Yeah. What is he talking about there in terms of like here's what. So we're talking now about transformations because that's been raised by Romans 12:2. And. Option number one is toward the will of, or excuse me, I think that actually it's the mind of God, isn't it, in the passage?
Perfect will of God.
It's the perfect will of God, okay.
It's on the floor, I think, Dave. I think it.
Oh, here's one. But what are the other kinds of transformations that people seem to undergo?
Child to adult.
Yep. And how smoothly does that usually go?
Let's see.
That is an anxiety-ridden transformation, if I recall. I wouldn't go through it again. Well, I haven't stopped going through it, but I wouldn't... go back to that age at all. Other transformations?
There was something there when he was wanting to be forgiven. And then he kind of, I was just listening, not reading, but somehow that was reconciled in his mind without it. Maybe I'm going down the wrong path.
No, I'm interested in what you're saying.
Finally just didn't become necessary that he be forgiven.
Okay. All right. So, well, another transformation, I guess, that people can go through is to turn around, right? Repentance. The regret, seeking forgiveness for what you've done, for example, is a transformation that's important in this story. Yeah. Good. Yeah.
So, a couple things that came to my mind. Things that you can't take back. You know, you go on that bus ride, and you don't, in that transformation, you can't go back. And it's kind of like the eggs and the binoculars. You throw the eggs and it's no big deal, but you throw the binoculars, it's something meaningful, something that you can't get back.
Right. I don't know exactly how to express that. This is one of the problems you have in the responsibility for writing on the board. But it is true in our lives, isn't it, that we grow through a lot of thoughtless processes. Unintentionally through sloth or habit or circumstances, we allow ourselves to be transformed, and we might regret a lot of that, and that seems to happen to the healer character in this story. Well, you got to ask yourself, why has he made a pilgrimage back to Lake Wobegon? We know a lot about Lois's circumstances in the story, but why has he come back specifically on this day to Lake Wobegon? Why is he really standing in the weeds by a ravine? What's going on with this guy?
It says he made a pilgrimage.
Yeah, it's a pilgrimage.
He was looking for his family, but his family's gone.
Right.
But these are the people who are there.
See, I think he's come there seeking something like love and affection. He doesn't get it. He finds his family gone. He doesn't get what he'd come back to town for. And he finds himself sort of lonely and depressed. And I don't want to push this too hard, but I think that's part of the mood of the story. Yeah.
And the question I thought as I listened was, is this about him or is it about the little girl or is it about whose story really is this?
Whose story really is this? I think that's a very, very good question. I think it's about both. I'm going to make the argument, in fact, that it's about both, and I'll try to set that up in a moment. Anyone want to follow up further?
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to the Romans verse. I think also embedded there is confirmation as well as transformation, as outlined by both the coffee and the ritual of moving at the table, that even though at this time she's supposed to be transformed, she's really just being pigeonholed sort of into the...
I agree completely. I think that the information we get about the confirmation service, it borders on satirical, actually. It isn't a wholehearted or loving version of the confirmation experience, is it? I think you're right about that. Fred wants to comment on this, too.
Oh, I don't even know if it fits. I'm stuck on the other Bible verse that seems to be so important, and that's the one alluded to about the sparrow is falling.
Yeah.
And how much this child about to be confirmed who loses her faith is like the sparrow that can't shut her eyes because it's not safe to sleep anymore.
Yeah.
The world is too darn dangerous.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, you're getting to some intricate patterning going on here. If you want to do this, and I think it's a really interesting place to take this story. I think Keeler is perfectly capable of this, by the way. I mean, he's a New Yorker writer, for God's sake. He's we get a contrast between the sparrows that God counts, which gives us what confidence that we are counted and known as well. Contrasted with the foolus, the fowls, who are having a more sexual awakening, a springtime sexual awakening, and we're invited in a sense to contemplate both as an emblem of this girl. The confirmation thing. I try when I lead discussions to stay out of things as much as possible and not just offer my own version of the story, but it seems to me that something like this is going on here. We get Lois on the one hand, and we get the storyteller, I'm tempted to call him Keeler, but the storyteller, Godfather, on the other hand. And they are joined, I think, by feelings of doubt, and lostness, and maybe even fear, which would be natural enough. I mean, isn't that the human condition, to feel anxiety, fear, and lostness? It seems to me it is. For Lois, all of this stuff is absolutely new and fresh. I don't believe, by the way, that she is especially faithless in this story. I mean, her first impulse when she sees a threatening stranger is to pray to God for... Of course, that's that compulsive kind of prayer, not heartfelt, I suppose, theological. What were we going to say? No?
Just
okay. You're allowed.
David, yeah. I want to throw something onto it. Yeah. I don't think she's faithless either, but I think she thinks she is.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't, this is a whole new awakening about what faith, what she thought it was. I memorize the Bible verses and I can spout back these answers that the theologians can't.
Right.
And if I can do that, I must have faith, and all of a sudden that doesn't work anymore.
Exactly.
You see this, all this reality coming in.
You just said better than I could have what I was trying to bring back to your comment, which is that this satire on the confirmation service is specifically a kind of theological satire. We tend in the church with certain rituals to take the most vexing, trying, anxiety-ridden questions we live with and turn them into memorization or something that's easy to handle that we spout off and then we move on, right? Like as though faith were, in fact, easy, as though it were a settled issue for all of us, and it isn't.
And don't you think that TV watching, I mean, that's huge. That's what we wonder about all the time, if God is a God of love, or where is this evil coming from?
Yep. Yeah, I was reading some Bible commentaries today on Romans just to see if there was anything that would give me an idea. And one of the claims made that I found most interesting is that, you know, what Romans is talking about there is not conforming yourself to a world that acts as though God is either dead or trivial, that acts as though violence is a natural thing, that we don't need to be outraged or horrified by it, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know, exactly. So we've got Lois, who is truly, what's the word I want? You know, spiritually awake, if not, you know, spiritually educated. She's spiritually awake. And then we've got the storyteller, who is, I think, more deadened, isn't he? To the kinds of spiritual dilemmas he's going through.
His own transformation, I think, is interesting when he says we pretend to be somebody we are not until we realize we become that person.
Yeah. Yeah, explain that if you can.
Well, if we are really into the concept of transformation, I think just an example might be, it has nothing to do with individuals, but in Latin American theology, they talk about if we want to be peacemakers, we can dream about being a peacemaker and pretend that we are, and if we are sincere about that, then we actually become that peacemaker. Mm-hmm. And so if this guy is a really lonely, lonely person, and he pretends to be somebody else because he can't stand being the person he thinks he is, and if he pretends long enough sincerely, he becomes transformed. Mm-hmm. I think we all experience that.
Right, exactly. So as a kid, what do you make of the fact that as a kid he wanted to be Tom Flambeau, son of Broadway actors?
Well, he was an
introverted, shy kid,
right.
And that's the exact opposite of what he really is.
Yeah, sure. I read it even a little darker than that.
But he wanted to be an actor. Didn't say he. I mean, his pretend world, he was an actor, right? Whatever.
But also, if you're an actor, you're not real. You move right into the pretend.
See, the external gratification that comes when you're an actor, everybody loves you, and he's.
But they don't know you.
Oh, right, right. But if you're scared of an intimate kind of a thing, then that's perfect.
There is the question too, isn't there, whether we ever stop acting?
Yeah.
I mean, when is the real me here present instead of the one that needs to pose as a genial English professor in a spiritual camp? You know, I mean, yeah, I don't know. That's a vexing question. I like what you're setting up here, which is that we do transform ourselves by taking on roles. We choose roles without full awareness at all times. We take ourselves down paths that we ought not go. You know, and maybe in some ways we pollute our lives. And here Lois is trying, I suppose, not to do that, trying her best to, you know, what is Lois actually seeking? I think it's lovely in this story. What is Lois actually seeking? love that's true instead of idiotic, peace and assurance in her life, a genuine sense of relation to God rather than the faulty, tricky relation that she feels today. What a great kid. What else, you know, does she represent or wish for in this story?
I don't have an answer to that, but I like what you're doing. What do you do with that? I'm going to be a good Samaritan, and she's real eager to do that, and then all of a sudden she's completely turns into, this guy's going to kill me.
Yeah.
Plug that into that one.
I wonder if it isn't a two worlds thing. It feels like she slides between two different frames of reference in experiencing the world. The one frame is the Lutheran Christian frame. So it's a Bible story that generates her notion of who that is that she's mm-hmm. going to meet and talk to. And the next moment, because she sees a glint of metal in his mouth, I don't know what the heck that's about, mm-hmm. suddenly she's in a TV series. Actually, it feels more like a Flannery O'Connor story to me, but she's in a TV series where her life is threatened by some violent stranger. And I don't know, maybe Keeler does nothing more than ask us, isn't it true that we live in both of those worlds at once? That we ourselves mediate between those two worlds in our own experience. I don't know. Your turn.
That's what teachers do.
Fred.
I'm still stuck on the sparrow.
Yeah.
Since the sparrow gets the last word at the end, sort of,
yeah.
of the story. I mean, I think, forgetting for the moment about the storyteller, Lois is discovering that she's a sparrow, and the promise of Jesus in that text is not that the sparrow doesn't fall, but only that God knows it falls.
Right.
And she's becoming aware that there's danger everywhere.
Yeah.
There's danger even from kids who write you long letters.
Yeah.
There's danger like whatever happened to Anne Frank. There's danger in good works.
Right.
She can't sleep anymore like the sparrow because the sparrows will fall. And somehow is it the storyteller only who is brave enough at the end to live in a different world than the one in which the sparrows fall? I mean, Lois hasn't got there yet.
He's not brave enough either. I mean, on the bus, well, when he was a kid, on the bus, he had to retreat from the fantasy that he was other than. He had to be known as God knows us, or he was going to be freaked out. So he felt the same feelings that Lois does, it seems to me.
Yeah, I agree, and there's no bus back.
And that's the
problem.
He went and
took a bus back, and sorry.
That's the problem with experience, is that there's no bus back from that. Yeah. Yeah.
But then the last two or three sentences are so much more optimistic than the stuff prior to that. And that's the storyteller speaking as well.
Yeah.
So maybe there's an epiphany for him right then.
Yeah.
Because those, to me, don't match the mood that this thing had through the whole story.
Well, I'm compelled by what Fred just had to say. I think it's an absolutely sincere expression of our faith in God's promise there at the end. But there is a sense, too, in which it feels a bit like a moral tag to me on the story. The story is very much about anxiety and the kind of anxiety we can't control. But there is this sort of moral tag that tells us we should.
So who's saying that at the end? And if it's the storyteller, does he believe it or not?
Keeler seems to believe it.
Yeah.
Well, we can be great at the end.
I'm sorry?
Maybe he's saying lighten up now.
Yeah, he might be saying lighten up. That's what we have to do at the end of each tale, isn't it? It's lighten up. That's true. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Fred.
Well, at the end, we seem to be given bravery as a possibility. I wasn't quite sure what he meant by this lovely world can make us brave.
I'm not sure I understand.
It seemed to be the world that was handing out gifts or faith, but mm-hmm. Maybe in the Chaucer poem, that's the point. But just the promise of that scripture verse is that that at least God knows. We don't, we're going to fall, but we don't fall unnoticed. So maybe there is some bravery to take from the fact that though we fall, we are noticed like the sparrows.
Does it strike you as important at all that, I mean, it seems to me there might be a paradox at the core of this story, and that is that on the one hand, we've got Romans telling us that we need to be transformed. We need to be other than we are. And yet the story of the sparrow says we will never be other than we are fundamentally, that in God's eyes we will be recognized by God as ourselves. There's this question of identity at the heart of the story that I haven't quite sorted out yet, that I think are tied up with the images of the birthday candles on the confirmation cake, which I don't know about you, but they don't do that in Heartland, Minnesota. They don't put birthday candles in the confirmation cakes. So that seemed to be contrived for some special reason. And then how about the eggs that are thrown into the woods by the scout keeper? There are these symbols of origin going on throughout the story that I haven't made sense of yet, but there seems to be a paradox there about our responsibility to change versus our responsibility versus the fact that we are simply known by God as ourselves. I don't know. I'm no theologian.
I wonder if the sense of faith, when she's being confirmed, she's supposed to be a faithful Christian, faithful Lutheran, and she does, she's feeling she's lost her faith, but then this whole transformation, she feels she needs to be transformed, I think.
Uh-huh.
So she drinks the coffee to help her in her transformation.
Uh-huh.
But she gets very scared.
Uh-huh.
And then I think it's scary, too, to be confronted by God.
Yeah.
And to be able to say that God knows me is a scary thing to me. Because who does God love?
Uh-huh.
Who am I in that relationship?
Mm-hmm.
And that whole transformation process is a mystery.
Yeah. A number of mysteries running through this little tale, I think. Yeah. Go ahead.
I think I know why this is coming to my head, but I'm not sure. Milton has that story, Comus, where this woman, if I have this right, they wants to meet her lover, not her sexual lover, but her betrothed, that's a better way. In the woods, and her brothers won't let her go because they're afraid she'll lose her chastity. And then the poem becomes an argument for virtue untested isn't really virtue.
Mm-hmm.
So she can't, I mean, they could keep her locked in a cage and she'll remain chaste, but that's not chasteness. And I'm thinking, you can stay in this innocence world of Lois and where Keeler would like to take the bus back to, but you can't stay there. And if you do, you're really not of faith anyway.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that story popped into my head, but I'm wondering about Lois and then this end, the very ending. In some ways, it's not very comforting to know I'm falling and God's watching, but thanks.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that scary world of faith is a, I don't know, I got a connection that's in my head, fuzzy. But
I like that a lot, and what it helps me remember is something simple that I haven't said about the story, and that is that the loving kindness shown by the Keeler character in the walk in the walk to the lake, I mean that is neighbor love, it seems to me. There's this girl, she's feeling anxious, she's had a big day, and there's the godfather saying patiently, "I'll take a walk with you, we'll talk." I think that's quite lovely, you know, that
well. Isn't that why everybody keeps going back to Lake Wobegon to have that renewal?
Yeah.
Discover one's roots and be replenished.
Yeah.
That's good. We do that too. But in readers, we go back to Lake. That's why we listen to the show.
Sure. No, absolutely right.
Well, that's why you guys keep coming to Hope Village.
Sure.
That's true. Hope is on the other end, though.
Steve?
So are you saying that faith has to be tested for her to.
Well, whether the word is test would be a good word or just awaken. I like the word there. Spiritually, I would make it awakening. In the process,
I always wondered, and I don't, how is it that a 13-year-old or however these confirmants are, that is the age where you have to get your mind around these his questions about faith.
Right.
I mean, why is it, other than tradition,
right,
First Communion, Confirmation, whatever you want to do, why it has to be at a 13, how a 13-year-old's mind can get around this? Well, I would want the rote memorization dispute back.
Yeah, I suppose arguments could be made.
They'd spend a whole lifetime trying to figure that out.
Yeah, well, when are we developmentally ready really to grapple with these questions? That's an interesting question.
Yeah. I was going to say.
Traditionally, it happens your first year of college, and religion departments aren't to blame very often. But.
Yes. I think coming back to this idea of bravery, I think you kind of see Lois play that out through her sort of questioning of what is going on around her. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it isn't important if at the end that she's the one who calls him on, you know, she feels as a 14-year-old comfortable enough to call him on his story about
that's
the
nice.
Eggs and the binocular.
That's nice. I like that. In other words, she engages him as an adult, doesn't she? Yeah.
Right.
Right. She says, no, that's not true.
So that's when she's more adult than when she's sitting at the table.
Right. Right.
That's good.
Good.
Our lovely world has the power to make us brave,
mm-hmm.
and the transformation and the bus not being able to go back is the experiences that you get in our world,
mm-hmm.
that you have to be brave for.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And that you can't rewind back again.
And you can't go back,
mm-hmm.
because now you have it. And now it's done. And it's
mm-hmm.
the transformation of from child to adult,
mm-hmm.
from getting through that really tough time.
Mm-hmm.
Just even the title of Godfather. This stranger is the Godfather.
Right, right.
For her journey.
Oh, and by the way, nice contrast to set up in the story. He's the kind and genial Godfather, as opposed to, was it Val Tollefson? Is that the name?
Mm-hmm.
The guy who
right.
has this
prayer
assigned
prayer.
Role of prayer parent, but
mm-hmm.
he's in fact an unkind
mm-hmm.
jerk to her. Telling her she doesn't have the sense God gave peace, etc. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, by the way, one of the sources of her doubt, right? The meanness she sees in other people who claim to be believers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, as you see, there's a lot going on here in this story, and another Keeler story on Friday if you're interested. Again, as I tell you, the story for tomorrow is quite different. It is not Christian spirituality we're dealing with. It's Spokane Indian spirituality, if anything. I know nothing about Spokane Indian spirituality, but I think I can help, or at least I can receive your notions, those of you who want to come, about how this story is knitted together and what it might have to say about the human experience. So if you're genuinely interested in coming tomorrow and you want to read the story overnight, come and grab a copy of the story for me. It's Sherman Alexie's What You Pawn, I Will Redeem. 4:45 tomorrow, I forget where, but it'll be. Thanks very much for a great conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.